And I learned actually sometimes the difference between right and wrong from someone who carried themselves in a way, in a dominating way, in a group of men. I knew very quickly in life that I wasn't going to be that alpha. I wasn't that. People sense it on you. They feel it on you. And the way you carry yourself, I just didn't have that thing. I've never been at 4 a.m. in someone's kitchen with 12 lads and gone, cool, it's quiet in here.
Have you always been like a funny guy?
I think people laughed at me before they laughed.
Welcome to another ep of Man Made with me, Pete Wicks. Today we have one of my favourite comedians, Tom Davis. He is an actor, comedian, writer. I mean, basically he's a jack of all trades. He is best known for his kind of larger life personality and size, because he is about 9 foot tall, which I think people generally have a misconception about who he is. He's spoken, you know, openly about anxiety, burnout and all sorts of stuff. So I cannot wait to hear more from him. Yeah, I hope you enjoy it. What do you think makes a good man?
So, yeah, I mean, it's
straight in.
No, it's good though, isn't it? I think it. You know,
there's no foreplay here.
Straight to bed, Pete. I think experience is a big thing. I think it's a misconception in life, and as we talk now, I think people who've had experience in different levels of good or bad or whatever. I don't think there's anyone who's truly, oh, that's a good person, that's a bad, you know, obviously, yeah. Extremes. But I think it's experience. I think it's what's your intentions? I think if the intentions of someone are good and you're looking out for others, I think that's a decent thing. I think it's important to look at family and treat that as well as you can. I think certainly in becoming a dad, one of the things that I was really, really conscious of was having seen quite a lot of my mates over the years not necessarily take that as a, you know, as the honour it is to be a father. I mean, that's a really, really big thing. And watching people just, you know, piss it away or just not be ready for that.
Yeah.
I always found quite a sort of a thing that's, you know, when we were just sort of talking just before here, that was a time where I was like, actually, I'm going to not drink it on here. Not just because I was like...
To be the best version of yourself.
Yeah, and I wasn't like, oh God, I've got a real problem. I love drinking and I still now miss it, you know, to an extent. But it was like, I was terrible at, you know, having one or two and then it'd be 4 o'clock the next morning.
Yeah,
I'd be in someone's flat somewhere in Romford.
Mate, I'm the same. When people say I'm going to pop out for a fucking pint.
I also was like, someone's going to come for one or two.
Why?
Don't bother.
Yeah, it's a mate. I'm exactly the same. Yeah.
I can't. So I think being a good, but I think it's also, I think it's for other people to say as well.
Yeah.
Nothing makes me laugh more when you hear someone describe themselves as a good person. I think, no, that's for someone else to say.
Mate, 100%. It's similar to what I was saying about everyone that I know that knows you says what a fucking great guy you are. And I always think that is the kind of how you, it's a good test of whether someone actually is a good person.
I think we
can all say we're great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we would love to think that. But when people talk about you, the way they talk about you when you're not there, I think is a real testament.
I think it's also, and I don't know if this is good, but I also think preconception is a really dangerous thing. I think when meeting people and the people that you talk about, and we were talking about before we started this, I think it's very easy in this industry to come to things with a preconception of someone and think of someone. And I've tried as hard as I can, coming from the background I do and the world I've come from, and certainly I think that preconceptions that were probably made about me as how I look or my background that people might have, very different from that, I think. And that was a very hard thing when I started stand-up. Mm. It was a very difficult thing, because when you walk on stage, everyone in the audience they're straight away going to go, all right, this is what I think he's going to be like.
Yeah.
So within seconds, you've got to make sure that they're not thinking, they're like, okay, no, you break that.
And is that a conscious thing? Do you, or is it just?
Are you conscious
of that when you go on stage?
Yeah,
like, because of the way.
It took me a while because it was like I was very full when I first got into it. I probably used that a bit, and like when you were talking again about boxing before we started this, and I boxed when I was young. I was terrible, like you said. I wasn't very good at it. I wasn't very good at any sport, but I tried the best I could. The only thing I could look at stand up. I didn't have training or as actor or anything. I'd never been like to any drama school. I was literally coming to it quite raw, just having watched things that I liked. So I sort of took that the only thing I had was sport. So I used to go out like I was in a boxing match. And I used to sort of come out with a level of like, it's a bit like a, you know.
Yeah.
And actually the best lesson I got was, no, it's not a battle. This, we're all in this together, the audience and you. Everyone's here to have a good time.
Yeah.
As soon as you can put everyone, rest assured that, oh, well, actually this is going to be fun. This guy's going to be a laugh, which I think I am in as a person. That's what I try to do. And I think that was the moment. And we were talking about, say, Vicky, for example, the amazing
One of our very, very good friends.
When we got her to do Murder It's Successful, it was a bit of a preconception because she was, I think, just come out of Geordie Shore at that point. Yeah. She certainly wasn't.
I remember her doing it. Like, you know, she's been one of my best mates for fucking 15 years. And I remember her doing it. And she's had a massive struggle over the years with people taking her seriously.
Yeah.
Because of that kind of background that she comes from reality TV. But she's one of the most witty, intelligent people, isn't she?
And also, it's a weird thing because I was obsessed with all these shows. So I'd watch.
You actually?
Yeah, like me and my wife. If I went on Mastermind, that would be my. There's a lot of reality show that at some point I haven't been obsessed. Like Towie, I was obsessed with.
Fuck
Made
off.
In Chelsea. Mate, but you know, you like Geordie Shore, I find them as a comedian, as an actor, they're almost the best things to watch because you're getting real humanity. Like for the
observational,
most part, yeah, you're watching people and you'll pick up, even now, to a fairly high level. But when you're watching those things, things people say, things people do, you're getting as I've got older, I've got a lot more. I'm in bed 8:30 most nights, so I'm living vicariously
through the fucking. From
the kids on below
nice,
deck.
Nice. Like, below deck. I mean, like you mentioned, like the misconception people had, like you come from working class background.
Yeah.
I think we come from fairly similar backgrounds, you know what I mean? And like, obviously I'm fucking covered in tattoos. Like if I, you know, my best mate lives in fucking Chelsea, I go over there, everyone has their handbags and like the way I speak. And I always get conscious of that. Or if I go and do anything, you know, I used to have, before I ended up being a fucking bum and in this industry, I used to have like a proper job. Yeah. Like, I would be tattooed up to here and then to there so that no one could see that. And I would change the way I speak so that people didn't think I was just some fucking gutter rat. For you, you were a scaffolder, did manual labour, you're a big guy, you come from a working class background. Stereotypically, you are like the fucking alpha male.
Yeah.
Like if people saw you, it'd be like, that's a fucking geezer.
But then it's a weird thing because you'll know this. Real geezers don't think that about me. No. Real geezers can tell a mile away that isn't me.
That you're soft
like,
as shit.
Yeah. See, like they're like hounds and they could tell straight away from the moment I think any site I'd work on, any time you're around, like it's a very like alphas like that. They know their shit, and they will constantly. They'll be like, "No, yeah, he's all right. He's not here for that." Do you know what I mean? And I think, and it would be a difference between I think an alpha and a bully is a big thing. A bully 100%. Straight away will be like, oh, "Okay, like, I can pick this guy up.
Biggest one in the room." That's the fucking
And that's a very different thing, and it's a different thing because I think there's an element now we talk about alphas in a very like. We can, in a sort of quite disparaging way, we can talk about alphas as being like quite a negative. And actually, I think there's a misconception. I think there's two different things going on. I listen to podcasts. I listen to people talk about like this, who almost study it from a distance. You've grown up in it. I've grown up in it. Most of my formative years were in a very masculine, male-dominated workplace, like the people I'm around. And I think like when you talk about alpha, I think there's some of the people I work with, I'll be like, no, that's, I learned a lot from that person. I learned actually sometimes the difference between right and wrong from someone who carried themselves in a way, in a dominating way, in a group of men who wasn't always like, that's not a guy who's picking on people, who's aggressive.
Yeah.
He knows enough about himself. And there's a masculinity there that I actually think is quite important. You know, it's like anything. It's, you know, that Spider-Man adage of like, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
A bully is different from that.
Completely.
And I think sometimes with how we now view, you know, I think what is an alpha and what is, you know, what isn't, I think that's a bit, I go, okay, that's a weird thing.
I mean, in any kind of situation, in any like social circle, there is always a dynamic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, as much as it's always everyone's kind of on an equal playing field, and I believe that, there's always a personality dynamic where some people are more outgoing, more, have them qualities that I would say are more leader led.
Yeah.
And then some people kind of prefer a follower. I've got a lot of mates like that.
Yeah.
I love I'm a control freak.
Yeah, my wife is a control freak. My best mate, who I'm business partners with, a control freak. I'm very easy to. I'm a sheep.
So my best mate's a Sam. He's a fucking sheep.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm like the fucking control freak, and that's just. But I would hope never in like a bullying way. It's just a different kind of mentality.
No, but I think. But that's the thing, isn't it? Because I think people need different things from different people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's also in a group of like you know, you think I always think that like a stag do is just like hierarchy. It's like a social dynamic.
Yeah,
who's going to take control? And then, you know, who's, where you're going to fit. I think it's always an interesting thing to go. I knew very quickly in life that I wasn't going to be that alpha. I wasn't that. I just didn't have that. And I think actually a little bit like the sort of like, you know, the jungle, I suppose, in a sense. Like I think with animals, it's like people sense it on you. They feel it on you. And the way you carry yourself, I just didn't have that thing. From school, I was never that kid. And I never really wanted to be. I never thought and that's now when you look at it and look where I'm at and what I do for a living and everything I dealt with that was to be funny. I was always like, okay, I'll have a laugh. I'll take the mick out of myself, you know, be self-deprecating. But also, you know, got myself, I probably got myself in more trouble for taking the mick out of the wrong people than I did.
But I mean, coping mechanisms is an amazing thing. Like for men, I think we are, we're amazing at finding the wrong coping mechanisms as opposed to the positive ones. And it's only really after you've done every negative coping mechanism can that you work out what the positive ones are. Like, were you confident, like, growing up? I mean, what did being a man look like for you? Like, working class backgrounds, being a man for me was you don't talk about fucking emotions, you don't cry, you fucking try and win everything, be competitive, don't let anyone give you any shit, and if they do, give them a slap. That was kind of our grow up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is the complete opposite to what I would deem being a man is. Like, vulnerability, weakness, all them sort of things. It's only now, I'm really in the last couple of years, that I thought to fucking hell, actually, that's what a positive, being in touch with that kind of emotional side. I know it sounds like airy-fairy.
No, but I agree really with all does. That. I agree with everything you say. I think I do a podcast with me and Ron when we talk about mental health and we talk about how we feel. I still am very guilty of, like, my cousin died last year and she was just a little bit older than me. And I remember, like, a big thing at the funeral was I looked around at all the men, and as special as this person was and as much she meant to me and my dad and everyone, none of the men were really crying. No. It's, you know, there was I think if one had, we'd have all you fallen. But all the women were so in touch with their emotions. They were so emotionally present. And like in my private space, I did that. But I think we still have, you know, a long way to go. But there's also like there's so much going on, I think, under the hood of like when we talk about men's mental health. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And I look at how people are just completely almost trying to reinvent the wheel. You know, for a long time, the sort of struggles and stresses of it, and I still have that now, you know, as a dad, as a husband, as a provider, as someone who wants, you know, there's times in my life where I look at it and think, you know, am I enough as any of these things? Am I any good at these things? And I don't articulate that enough. I don't turn around really and go and ask that question. I just sort of like blunder on through. And actually, I think I'm a little bit more on that with my wife. We chat a lot.
The way you just described it about women being more emotionally present, I think is like the perfect way, because regardless of gender, we all feel the same things. We all have the same capacity to feel different emotions, sadness, loneliness, fucking whatever it may be. For me, like when I was younger, everything just presented itself as anger because I didn't really fucking understand what I was feeling. I couldn't, because that wasn't like a thing, men don't feel fucking sad or lonely or any of that shit. And it's only really like a few years ago. And that's part of why I ended up doing this pod is not for let's talk about it, which is what we always talk about when it comes to men's mental health. It's more because the thing that no one really talks about is listening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I've got my stand-up show to talk about exactly that.
Yeah.
Because I look at it and think, me and you have got, I've never been at 4 a.m. in someone's kitchen with 12 lads and gone, it's quiet in here. Yeah. No one's got anything to say. Everyone's rambling on. Everyone's got a joke. Everyone's got something to say. The truth is, no one turns around and goes, I think Mark's going through it a bit.
Let's
all quiet down and have a look, because he's been crying in the corner for an hour. Have a listen to Mark. It's the thing we have is there's still such a stigma around all this.
Yeah.
And also we have men have a very like, like one-upmanship even with mental health has become a thing. I was out there.
No, I'm struggling more than you. No, yeah, you fucking ain't, mate.
You want problems,
you want problems.
Have a shit now, grab yourself a drink, mate. I'll give you problems. It's a bizarre thing.
We're
that
just
we
just a competitive fucking no, it's no, mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy even with that you go, oh wow, okay. Yeah. We're not across but also it's I think the explanation has to be clearer. I think you have to, like I say, we talk about it, and I try to be as open as I can, and then I sort of sometimes catch myself and think, oh, no, is there an air of hypocrisy here? I need to be better at that. Certain things. I need to be more open. I need to sort of talk more about what's actually going on day to day. I think the struggle of things and how your brain works, your mind, and is again when you talk about misconceptions and I think this the cloak of fame is a very very weird thing, and in the time I've been in this industry, I've watched sadly, you know, sort of, you know, people, yeah, you know, people be hit as hard as you can by that, and seen some truly horrible things. I think the idea that the cloak of fame kind of makes you invisible or less vulnerable to day to day struggles and day to day problems is a real worry. And even people I adore and I love, I just watch and just, you know, from the very highest, you know, people I've worked with, who you go, oh, they'd almost be completely like, you know, they're not going to struggle with this thing or this thing that your mate, you know, who's out laying bricks is. Yeah. But they do, everyone does. Yeah. And I think that it's a very interesting thing. And sometimes even with my mates, I might say, we'll be out and I'll say something, I'm finding this hard. No, no, fucking it. How can you find it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't know what hard is.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, as soon as you kind of put yourself in the public eye, whether it by accident or you end up wanting to kind of be in that, it's people always just assume life's great because, and especially with social media.
Yeah.
Because social media, no one puts the
we have to be
shit.
Careful with social media. Yeah. Like but we have a debt now, or like that we have to be really now, I think personally, we have to be as genuine as we can be.
Yeah.
Because actually the danger is, and like, you know, having been a dad, also sometimes just myself and even my wife, you look at, like there's times where I look at people, Vicky's very good at that. Vicky's very open on there. And sometimes I think almost to her detriment where she gets like horrible comments.
Yeah.
But she's very open about how she feels at any one time. I think we all have to be like that.
Yeah,
I think
it's authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah. Because I think sometimes, you know, you could, like perfection, I just think it's just such a insane thing to aim for.
It's non-existent.
And it is that weird thing of when, you know, when I remember sort of, you know, watching reality TV, I mean, there was a time of reality TV where you were watching it and people were making so much money out of it. And you're like, as a normal person going to work. It's
fucking
like,
miss them,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fuck's sake.
You've done all right.
Fuck's sake.
There's people cursing you, Pete Wicks. Let me tell you. He was only in the show for three fucking years. I had 12 series of that thing.
Do you know what? It's mad because, like, I always say this, the whole kind of mental health thing, I find it a really difficult... I didn't really want to do this pod. I didn't want to fucking do a book because I didn't really want to get involved in...
By the way, I've got so much respect you've written. I've been writing a book for about 4 years. I can't get any closer to the end of it.
Mate, do you know what it's really... It was more... I selfishly did it for me.
Yeah, but I think you've got to.
Because it was cathartic.
But that's everything,
I said, by the way. Yeah, there's no such thing as a fucking selfless act.
I think you're doing this pod for you because you might be learning to be better. And
I hate
it's going to help
pod. No, but on a serious note, and I mean that, I get to speak to some amazing people, but part of it is it makes me think. It's almost forcing myself to do it because you hear different people's experiences and it kind of becomes... I'm forcing myself to have conversations.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's kind of, you know, what we don't necessarily do because I don't have them outside of having this pod.
That's
part of, like, I think the whole mental health thing with it, you know, gender, it's completely genderless. Everyone always says, you know, do this, speak to a therapist, do this, do this, do this, do this. There's no one size fits all answer because no one will ever think and feel the way you do. No one will ever think and feel the way I do. So it's quite disconcerting for people when they try all these different things and then nothing fucking works and they think, look, I'm more fucked than anyone else.
Yeah.
But actually, you're always going to be a work in progress. There's no fucking cure.
No.
It's just always been a work in progress. Just making sure you have more good days than bad days.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's
but it's all that comes just down to feelings in general, right?
Yeah.
I was talking to my friend on the way over here, and he's been through a really tough time recently, and talking about grief. And when you talk about something like grief, and how people should feel. Again, television, films, social media, like even like happiness, grief, we're all told what these are, almost like, but not what, one size doesn't fit all. Like you can, someone, the most important person in your life can die. And the way that hits you is never going to be like mirrored to anyone else. You
no
can
one
deal
will
with
ever
that
understand.
Work. Yeah, but also how you deal with it day to day, how it goes, what you're going through is not going to be the same as Mick who walks past or Claire. It's all going to be very different. And I think the fact is, like, the more you actually just, the more you become aware of how you deal with things and how you, it's so, so important. I'm a believer in therapy. I think therapy is important. Yeah. But I'm also a believer in trying to get out and actually have a conversation and actually talk. And that, sometimes it's not even about, like, I live almost quite an isolated life sometimes. I think, like, I'm out, a gig, I spent, like, at home with my, I have a great relationship with my wife. You know, we have quite an open conversation. But there's times where you need laddie banter. And I think banter, by the way, is the most underestimated thing.
I agree.
My relationship with Romesh is built on that. It's built on chatting to Mick and having a laugh, where you can go to him and I can go be really open about it. But also, the thing about men that's very, you know, but actually that is really cathartic. Yeah. Going out and having a joke and taking the piss out of people, each other, and knowing your limitations, knowing your boundaries, of course. But actually, that's a real, I grew up with that. I never at one point, number one, I would say that when people are taking the piss out of you on a building site and you're having a joke, if they're not doing that, you go, oh, no one likes me. I feel very much outside. If you're a part of it and you're giving it and you're taking it and there's a bit of a camaraderie, and it's one of the things I miss most. It was a nice thing to be like, because it's quite inclusive and you know the stuff you're not going to joke about. You know, there's a misconception that people will say this or say that. You know where the boundaries are.
Yeah.
But it's actually quite a nice thing just to sit and just joke and laugh. And some people could argue, oh, you're not actually getting into feelings. But you're like, well, no, you walk away kind of uplifted from just being around people.
I think that's the thing, is it's, you're not necessarily getting into feelings, explaining exactly how you feel, but you always come away from it feeling better than you did when you got there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that's just as important sometimes. It's I completely agree with that. And I think it's a weird thing. I've got lots of like female friends and it's amazing because I feel like they understand emotions and that more.
I will say, by the way, female friends, some of my female, like Vicky, mate, it's got more banter.
Mate, they're more savage.
Can I say, and I don't mean any offense if it's cool, as a dad dropping off the kids, I'm always chatting to the mums. The mums have got so much more banter.
Mate,
than
but
this.
They actually do, yeah. don't
oh,
they?
Mate, all day long. If you're at the gates, and look, this is now, you know, there's some great dads. But if I'm there, the mums, there's a politeness with guys, men. Yeah. You've got to get to know each other. It's a sort of air
of, it's
like,
a bit of a cock off initially, isn't it?
Yeah, like, and it's also you get like a bit of distance. Like, mums will turn around and coat you for a pair of shoes you got on.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. And you think, oh no. And then you go, oh, straight. But that is straight away, it's inclusive and it's, you know, it doesn't necessarily, I think, it's that difference that we have between what is bullying and what is being mean and what is the intention of your act. And that's what I guess I'm getting back to from when you said about what's a good person or a good man. I think if the intention is mean, to make someone upset, if someone's saying something, if I'm going to say something to you, it's a very different thing if I'm having a joke here and you go, oh, this is a joke, between that and being aggressive, or you'll know what the intention is.
Yeah, completely.
I you know, in the world that you grew up in, I grew up in that working class environment, you know the difference between someone coming up and having a bit of a laugh and a joke and someone coming up and the intention is aggression.
You can call someone a silly cunt in three different ways.
Also,
it means three different things. Do you know what I mean?
You sorry cunt.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
I think it's one of the, in my first show, we had to cut it out, but one of my best bits was like, it's a terminal endearment. One of the sweetest things I ever see. I see a couple splitting up at Westlife. I was there watching, I love Westlife. I was sitting, and
the band?
The band. I fucking love them. I went on my own. It's very hard to get
fuck
a gag.
Off.
Oh, mate, I'm telling you now, my top listen to songs, everyone else is putting it, I love a drop of Westlife. I love a drop of Boys. I love a ballad. I like a boy. I'm Westlife. They was at the Royal Variety. I was like sat backstage. I'm like, I fucking tanked that night. I wasn't great. I sat and watched that. I goes, you know what? This is, my wife was like, don't lose your shit. I was like, how can I not? Yeah, I mean, Mark wasn't there. That was a kick in the teeth.
Oh, fucking hell, mate. I mean, country music's my thing and everyone takes a piss out of me.
I love country.
Country music.
Yeah.
If there's something that I can cry to and rock back and forth on the end of my bed, then do you know what I mean? Like, I'm all over
Westlife
it.
Westlife does that for me. Yeah. But I see a couple arguing and then a song kicked in. And I remember the geezer, he turned around and he said to me, I could see that sort of them chatting just in front of me, and the guy went, I fucking love you, babe. And she went, oh, you silly soppy cunt. And it was such a sweet moment. because it was made so affectionately.
It's humour, I think, and we're going to get onto like from your background of like manual labour and that sort of thing to in comedy, because it's not something that you kind of, I don't know, like, you didn't mean to kind of do it. You, like you said, you didn't do drama school and all the rest of it. I think humour is one of the best things. Like, I've always used humour as a fucking deflection and a coping. Like, you know, I lost my nan, she brought me up, she's my best friend. If I'd have got married while she was here, she'd have been my best man. And people never, she was my friend before she was my nan. I was just blessed to have her as a nan. But the way we used to talk to each other, like, you know, even the last couple of years, she'd be like, what are you doing, you little wank, staying up? Like, you're not dead yet, you old witch. And people are like, how do you speak to each other like that? And it is, it's the term, that was just our relationship. And like comedy for you, have you always been like a funny guy? Do you know what I mean? Like, how did it all come about?
And I think people laughed at me before they laughed at me. I'm going to be completely honest. It was a coping mechanism from a very young age. I was dyslexic. I was an awful pupil. I wasn't a mean kid. I was loud. I was thrown out of the class quite a lot of the time just for disrupting and just, and I struggled academically. Like, I grew up in a world where, you know, you were around quite hard people, quite strong, you know, dominated men and good guys. People are, you know, some of them terrifying, but that was always my thing. I'd always be able to, if you could crack a joke about yourself quickly off the bat, it straight away is like, okay, cool.
It's like, disarming for people, isn't it?
But also, I don't take myself too seriously. Yeah. I never have. In what we do now, I love it. It's the best thing in the world. Murder and Success, you know, you talk about feeding people. The best thing about that show is you're bringing people in to be funny with you. It's not like, my ego is not that big. I'm like, it's so much fun when you see people come in and having a laugh. So, you know, comedy was something, and I love it. I still got as much pleasure doing it as a job now as I used to just messing about and being silly and doing prank calls with my pals. Or
if there's like comedy, I've always thought, has got to be one of the, like, to do stand-up is that, I mean, that is fucking terrifying. Like, you know, I'm quite a confident fucking person, but that is fucking terrifying. Were you always quite confident?
No, I think I think...
And then coming into doing stand-up, I genuinely think that is one of the most lonely fucking places.
Yeah,
if you die a death on a stage, it must be fucking horrendous. Like, you must be the bollocks to go and do that.
Yeah, but I think the truth is, I think for most people, I think of mine didn't. I don't think mine came out of a confidence. It came out of a more like, I don't know what else I'm going to do with my life.
It was a necessity.
I was like, I'm fucking 32, and I'm like, I can't keep carrying fucking shoes for a living. It was like, I just thought, give it a punt. I'd failed at most things. I thought, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it's just nothing else.
Just add it to the list of fucking, add it to the list of shit in the corner. We'll check that one off. That's no good. I will find something. I'd love to know what would have been next on the list if it had failed.
But I think it's a weird thing. I think there's certain, the thing I love about stand-up and comedy, you've talked to people that I love who on here and who are stand-ups. I see, like, Joel, for example, Joel Domit, who I think the misconception of Joel could be that he's really, really common. But when I remember first gigging with Joel and thinking, God, what, you know, but then it's vulnerability. That's the thing that people relate to. That's the thing, is finding that inner bit of you that feels so, like, with Joel, when I used to watch Joel, and I was like, I used to turn up at, you know, a gig with him, handsome geezer, absolute chiseled, like, out of granite.
He's a fucking good looking fucker, isn't he?
So good, and good at stuff. Good.
Yeah.
But when you get inside Joe, like, you get inside Joe's a bit.
Yeah. I don't know him that well. But,
we got close.
All right, you know him better than me. fine.
No, but when you get, like, you realise quite quickly the vulnerabilities of him.
Yeah.
You get to say, oh, okay, that's, and actually, I think when stand up is like, even what you could watch the most, like, confident person who you might sit in the audience and go, okay, that, but actually the truth is, it's the thing that you've come to watch is the vulnerability of it. It takes confidence. It takes big, you know, big kahunas. It takes a lot to get on stage in the first place, because there is, like you say, it's very, but actually once you, the best people that I watch do it, and the people weirdly out of the, you know, the generation that I came from, the stand-up generation, you know, the group that I was around and the people that I've watched day to day, like the best stuff was always the stuff where you're like, oh no, they're actually being honest up there and they're being vulnerable.
Yeah.
Above confidence.
But people, like, I think people always assume that audiences are fucking thick, and actually they can see straight through They can see straight through a lot of that stuff. People connect better to someone they can relate to.
Yeah.
And someone that's authentic in whatever you're doing, whether it be stand up or anything else. I always kind of think that all the people that I like are people that I think you're just real.
Yeah.
And then all the people that you kind of, everyone assumes that like, I think, no, you're a cunt. I can tell. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, so you started stand up and you had like Murder and Successful was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Also like acting wise as well, you've really fucking smashed that out of the park as well, didn't you? Fucking.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I find it a bizarre thing.
Not messing about with that one either, are you? I was a scaffold. I'll do a bit of comedy. I'll smash that. Acting. Yeah, fuck it. Go on. I'll give that a go. Smash that.
It's very strange because you're like, I never had any intention on the acting thing.
Yeah.
I never did. People like have this thing where I remember like you do interviews when I first started out and people are like, oh, did you always want to be a comedian and actor? And you go, oh, no.
It was insane. I was just into everything else.
Yeah, it was just insane, the idea that I'd be sitting at a school, you know, like a job fair and going, oh, I'm going to be a thespian. It's like, oh, I'm being filmed. You're all right, you fucking idiot. That was never on the agenda.
It's silly cunt.
No, don't let him drive a wheelbarrow. It'll be all over the place. He's got one leg slightly longer than the other.
just going around in circles.
Cement just all piled up down the street. But the misconception of that was, it was always like, that was just a pipe dream. And all of it, like, and I'm very grateful and blessed that things turn out the way they are. But a lot of that's hard work. That's the thing that I look and think, everything comes back to like that. It doesn't matter whether you're labouring or whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
The big thing for me was like, when I looked around at Pete and I first got into this game, I used to look at other people and think, quite, they're so good at that. They're how they word things, the confidence they might have, the fact they've got, you know, I'm just going to have to, my only thing that I can bring to this is I'm going to have to work harder than anyone else. I have to graft as much as I can. And any time I've got an opportunity, I have to, number one, enjoy that opportunity and think that this is something I probably never thought was going to happen and it's a blessing.
Mm.
But number two, show it the respect it deserves and work hard to it. And I think when people, certainly when I first got into this, when you talk about misconception, and people would talk to me about, oh, you come from a building site, you come from da-da-da, you had to be like, you were like, and people almost talk it as a negative. I thought, no, that's the thing that's put me in the stead that I have, background.
It's comedy, or anything you do, I genuinely believe it's a trade, isn't it? It's learning a fucking trade and giving it the respect to actually fucking research and to be better at saying. But, I mean, so you had like, I mean, a lot of success, but you've spoken about anxiety and burnout and stuff, and then you stopped gigging for, 6 years?
6 years, yeah.
How did you go from kind of not really knowing the comedy thing, fucking getting loads of success, and then at that point then going, oh, fuck, it's too much? What was the feeling behind that?
I think firstly it was that, like, I stopped standing almost before, like, that was kind of... It was sort of alongside Murder and Successful, I guess. I just had such a feeling. Number one, I wasn't very good at it. And that's a really weird thing because...
What, at stand-up?
Yeah, I'd sort of got into it and I loved doing it. And it was always just kind of for me. It wasn't... I didn't come into it as, oh, this is going to be the thing, you know, career that I do next. It was like, this is something I think I'll enjoy. Well, and I was still, you know, working on the site. I was still doing a day's work. Then I'd go to, you know, somewhere... in the country to do a gig, then sometimes I have to get the night bus back, sleep in the Victoria, start to go back to work.
We're talking like all the working men's clubs, that sort of stuff.
I did some of them. Yeah, I did some of them. Then some more sort of like mainstream sort of, you know, a little bit of everything, which when I came back after 6 years, I think people thought, oh, he's just an actor who's going to try his hand at stand-up. They didn't realise that I'd done so much before that. But I think I then got, you have a manager and you have an agent, and that there was a time when I was getting pushed against doing the thing that was me.
Yeah.
Like, I think when I do stand up, the thing that I enjoy is anything can happen. It's not like tightly scripted. It's not like tightly wound. Obviously, I go out there with an idea of what I'm going to talk about, but every show is a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll get words wrong. I'll fuck up routines.
But it's a bit of adaptability to what you're
doing. Yeah, but
I
think there's nothing wrong than watching the wheels come off a bit. And then if it's the people I adore the most and I watch and I go, how do you deal with a problem? And if it fucks up a bit, it's quite funny to watch. And then it's how you, and then it's inclusive, and people in the, you know, you're present with it.
Yeah.
And then I was getting pushed into being like, everything had to be tight, everything had to be scripted, everything had to be so like finely tuned and so tight that I was like, there's not really, I'm not really enjoying this. And also I took the fact that I was getting, and this is wrong, and it's something I learned through time. I took advice and notes and things that people were saying to me as like they were sort of just like ripping me down a bit, as they were sort of, it was like they didn't think I was very good
at
what I was doing.
Not just self-esteem.
Yeah, but, and that was wrong on my point. You know, you talk about mental health. I'd never ever, like, I'd just gone out and done what I thought was funny, and I got a certain amount of way. And then people were giving me notes and people were trying to help, and I probably didn't deal with that in the right way. I was like, oh, they think I'm shit at this. They don't think I'm very good. So I then started taking that sort of headspace into gigs. I started, like, I wouldn't eat. I was so anxious about it. I could be doing a gig in front of six people, like, in a really small gig, and I wouldn't eat that all day. I'd be so tightly wound up. And I'd think, and the imposter syndrome of turning up and being shit, that someone would go, oh, did you hear he was at, you know, the coach and horses in Mitcham the other night in front of six people? He died on his ass.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's done. He's, yeah, like, back to the site you go. And I stopped enjoying it, and I just got so in my head about everything, you know, and just not being, I just thought, every time I'd write material, I'd think, oh, that's not good enough. Or I'd do something, I'd just think, oh, that's not funny. And at the time, the level was so high. All the people I adore and some of my best friends in this industry, I was watching, and I'd be like, oh, man, they're so much better than me. And like, I'm going to take this, you know, it feels like I'm doing a different thing than them. It felt weirdly like, you know, we joke, but like football, all the things I've been bad at school, I had the same thought process with that as I did. And, you know, and then I was doing some acting, and some of that was going well. And, you know, I was going, you know what, maybe this is the thing that I should do more of, because I just feel like this is something I might be better at than that. And, you know, I think, so I took some, you know, I took time, and it was in some ways, like, in some ways good, because I look at it and now I adore this. I adore doing stand-up. I do it, you know, I'm blessed. Flo, who's my manager agent, and completely was like, as completely, you know, he's like, this is what you should be. Like, that is the thing that you should. And she's been a friend for a number of years before she was an agent. And then, like, Romesh. And Romesh was, I adore the geezer. And you know, you talk about male friendship. He's like, I wouldn't be sitting here for a number of reasons. And there's a friend, he's like, you know, I text, you know, I think, like, it's a very similar relationship probably to you and Sam.
No, I hate,
I think,
you
know, yeah.
It's not the same. We're not the same, brother. No, listen.
You are, by the way, you're Romesh. You know, I'd love to be you in that relationship. You and Romesh.
No,
and me and Sam are our entities.
It's one of the things, like, male friendship is.
But you did a thing there, and I'm not going to. But you did a thing that men do, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't. Because men. And I used to do this with Rom, and he used to do it with me. And I said to him, I joke, but we all do this thing. Instead of going, I love that guy.
Yeah.
We all feel like.
Yeah, no.
You don't want to be
vulnerable.
You don't want to show vulnerability.
He's not like family. He's not my brother.
No, but we do it. We all do it. And that's why I think friendship works. But Ron was like, even like with his tour, he's so encouraging. He's so like, and that's it's a really wholesome friendship. We come from very, literally up the road from each other. Like, you know, it just so happened that we both got into the industry at about the same time. So
did you meet Romesh through the industry?
Yeah.
So
he's one of the people I watched stand up, and I gave up about a week. I watched Rom do stand up, right? You know, I watched him. I was like, oh, he's just going to go all the way. Like him, Beckett.
I love Rob Beckett.
Right? I was like, I adore Rob, and Rob's, I think, one of the most, like, he's again from a very similar background, but like. Mm. He's one of the most giving, most caring people you'd ever want to meet. But my word, I remember seeing Rob out the bat, like, straight, and look at him, go, you're like a superstar. You know, when people talk about footballers?
Yeah.
And like, you go, oh yeah, that kid, you know, Beckett, Romesh, Catherine Ryan, you're like, you're watching those three I just remember seeing and just thinking, wow. Like, that's Mo. I remember seeing Mo the comedian. Took people a while to discover Mo, but Mo had a charm about him, and like Mo's humour and how Mo used to go, like, and act. You know, it just, you watch people like that, you're like, wow, like the level is so high. And I felt like the thing I was putting out wasn't necessarily what made me me, and I was all of a sudden changing a bit just to because I remember doing a gig one night, a character gig. Before Beckett, I come off stage and Rob went, "You got something. It's not that." In a very honest, amazing way. But and again, it's like, well, you know, but it's like you try it and he is like,
"You've got something. It's not that.
It's not that, mate. Yeah. Don't do that again. Yeah. Do not." Yeah,
but that word.
No, but you know, also, do you know what? That's important about that. I listen to Rob Beckett and not Rob, but Rob. Because the way when Rob said that, that was like someone from a building site. So it wasn't someone who, who'd come through Oxbridge or someone who was really posh who I felt was talking down to me, and even though they weren't. And that was my misconception. That was a big, you know, double fryer, fucking fryer sitting on my shoulder.
Yeah.
When Rob Beckett talked to me, I took Rob as like, you know what? He's like me. He's from my world. And when Rob said that to me, I straight away, I didn't even second guess it. I was like, no, he's right.
Whereas
like, you know, we carry a thing in and it's actually quite, and I'm sort of hopefully better at now, but there's an inverted snobbery that I certainly came into this industry with. I was like, I think that people were talking down to me, but they really weren't. And I was probably a bit like, I probably sort of there carried myself in a way that I'm not particularly proud of.
Would you say you're still guilty of that now?
Not as much. I don't think as much now.
Yeah. Because I'm exactly the same. Yeah. I just assume everywhere I go, everyone's going to think I'm a stupid cunt.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, so then anything that fucking happens, I'm like, well, you think I'm a cunt anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
But like, you know what was really interesting? Like, and I didn't really know you, but when you, I hosted some awards.
Last year?
Right? Yeah, last year, and you won an award. And like, it's a really weird thing, right? And it's, I didn't know you. I know we've got such a lot of common friends. And,
yeah. You caught me in the toilet.
Yeah, I caught you, but this is an insane thing, right? And you won't believe. But I was so terrified about that gig because that gig is one of the most, it's very middle class, it's very TV. And I remember getting there and them talking to me and I was like, you know, and people were texting me, like, it's really hardest gig you'll do, da, da, da.
Yeah.
And my stuff's very relatable to where you come from and where, you know, it's very working, it is what it is. Don't get me wrong, it's not just that. But
no.
And I just thought, when I saw you in the toilet and you really put me up, I had a laugh with you, we had a chat joke. And I thought, I'm just going to play this whole thing to Pete Wicks.
Mate, honestly.
It's insane. But I thought, if I can get Pete Wicks on side, he's such a genuine chap. If Pete Wicks laughs, I think people around him might laugh and that might filter out.
Mate,
but I thought, if I've got one friend here, and I knew people in the audience, they were lovely, but I sort of was like, at that point, I was in my head so much, because I was like, they're not going to relate with some of this stuff.
Well, this is going to sound really wankerish. I fucking loved it because I see you in the toilet. And it was for the dog show, and it was a room full of people that are not necessarily my cup of tea. I felt really out of place, and I was like, listen, we're never going to fucking win.
Me and you are the only two people in velvet jackets.
Mate, 100%. And I thought, we looked like we were going to fucking prom. Everyone else looked like they were about to set a house
you,
on fucking Zoopla.
I could tell you, go and get the drinks, fucking Del and Rodney.
Literally. But so I sat down and you are with like these kind of TV people and I felt really out of place and I thought, I'm never going to fucking win anything here. And your opening line when you come on stage was at me and I doubled up. My manager, who also manages Vicky, went, oh, I fucking love Tom as you come on. And I went, I just spoke to him the time. He went, hello, Pete Wicks.
Yeah,
and I went,
Is
he just about me? Is he just talking about me? And I was fucking buzzing. I didn't give a shit about the award. The best part of the night was I got fucking name checked on stage. I was like,
you and Boyzone.
Boyzone.
But also what was lovely after that is the people come up and was very sweet. And so I try not to have that same, because it's kind of, you know, without, you know, I don't know if this is sort of like me trying to be deep and it's actually pretty, but actually, you know, the more you move through life, the more you navigate, the more you realise everyone's got their shit and everyone's got their thing. You kind of always have like almost like the tribe in which you come from is you carry that with a certain air of pride and you can almost become very like tribalistic on this is how I live my life. But actually when you, the more you sort of broaden your horizons, the more you're around people from different walks of life, different class systems, diversity, you realise actually, oh shit, do you know what I mean? It's every which person, every different case of person you meet is just very different. And I think if you walk through life doing that and actually just be a little bit more open-eyed to how people are individually, I think the world's a lot easier as a place to navigate.
Accepting change is one of the fucking hardest things to do. And it's not even just about accepting other people for change, but accepting yourself changing as a person is really difficult, because that mindset, when you're stuck in it, it's really fucking hard to get out of it.
Yeah, of course.
But I mean, your tour, so the Spud Gum.
Yeah.
So is this the first time you've been on like a stand-up tour for
second. So I did Underdog 2 years ago. That was like the first one. So that was
the first for 2 years.
So at 6 years, and then I flow with me, and I'd sort of, I've been doing the podcast a bit with Rom, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'll just try some small gigs and see where it goes, and just started loving it again. I was just like, this is the thing that's kind of been missing.
You finished with like the Hollywood films with Shyamalan and that thing, you know what I mean? Like Thousand Blows, Stephen Graham, like fucking reluctant vampire. Keep going. We're just throwing
a few more coming.
Fuck off.
No, but I was like, and also I was kind of like, I didn't, it was the thing I loved. It was the thing that moved me from one place in my life to another. And I sort of felt I've got a bit of unfinished business here. So it was very small at first. I was like, let's try this and try that, and working up to like what was an hour, and then the first tour. And then this is like, now I sort of feel like this tour is actually really a bit more, I think it's funny. I think I'm more open. I think I'm a lot more vulnerable. I think on stage, I think it's a lot more fun. I think, you know, I put so much pressure on that first tour to be perfect, you know, every night. And actually the nights when microphones broke or something went wrong, they're the ones I remember and go, oh, fuck, that was a great night here at the air. Well, there, you know, and actually now going out again, it's a very exciting prospect to be, and it's kind of, you know, it's a very special thing. Like you talk about those jobs, and I'm very lucky to have done all of them, but there's nothing like being in a room with, you know, people, and you feel in the light, you know, when you do Murder and Sex World, King Gary, and you know, you're not in the room with the people when they're watching it, and you might bump into someone, they've enjoyed it, and that, you know, but it's that moment where you crack a joke and people laugh along with you, and it feels like, you know, that's a fucking amazing thing to be a part of. You know, pinch me moment.
It's one of the hardest things, like man, woman, again, like genderless thing, but being present, it's, you know, I mean, everyone knows that I'm fucking dog obsessed. I prefer to people, but it's one of my favourite things about a fucking dog.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the most beautiful things is that right that moment, that is the best thing that's happening.
Yeah.
And like as people, we don't, you're always thinking about the past or the fucking future, and it's really difficult.
Catastrophizing.
Yeah, right? It's fucking terrible. Yeah.
It's the same as that, like, you know, I have like, you know, my little girl, I spend time with a number one. I'm like,
would you say that having a kid's changed, like, has it made you,
I think,
better?
So kind of without being like, as a part of it, it's, I think, just saved the world. What, like, it's nothing else really matters.
Joel said exactly,
you know,
the same,
it's
thing,
just like, that's it. It's like, and the journey I went on to have, you know, to have a child, we thought like a couple of years before that it just wasn't going to happen. We were told it wasn't, and we went for a long time with that, where, you know,
because you went through IVF and surrogacy.
So we were like, on the run up to COVID, we were like told we couldn't have kids, and you then go into this place where you're like, you know, you're just the two of you, you're just in this bubble together, and you're sort of having to deal with that in a way, and actually it brought us really, really close.
Had you always wanted kids?
Yeah, more, like, that's all I wanted. Both of us. All we wanted to be parents and to be a dad.
Mate, that's a devastating blow. Yeah,
And in some ways, I sort of think, you know, to my wife was, you know, touch and go whether she'd make it at one point.
Fuck.
So you're in a situation, you know, when I was leaving the hospital one day and they were like, you're the next of kin, right? And you're like, oh, fuck, okay. Like, so when you talk about, you know, leaving there that night, I remember, like, you know, my dog, and this will be a bit argument, you know, he's not with us anymore. Mm. And I remember just lying in bed with just me and him. I'm thinking, fuck, this could be it. She might not be coming home. Like, you know, when someone says next of kin, you're like, that's a very cold moment that runs through you. And then and I don't think I've ever perfectly got that down, but you think, you know, you start, I'm not a religious guy, but you sort of start making prayers with someone to go, look, just get me through this, get us through this, and that's enough. And when she, and she came out, and, you know, she came out on Christmas Eve of hospital. She got, and it was at Christmas, was, mum and dad came, they, you know, we put together some sort of lunch, but we hadn't bought presents because she'd been in hospital, and, you know, but it was like this, you know, and her then, you know, spending months sort of getting back to health and whatever. But you sort of then it's a cold light day, you start sort of like going, okay, that news that hits very hard, you're like, oh, shit, that's maybe not repairable. And then like an act of just selflessness, and someone got in touch, and something happens that then you're like, you're given a chance. And that was a moment for me where I'm like, I need to change here. There's like, you know, you sort of, you know, am I perfect as a, you know, some of my behaviour selfish? Yeah, it's, you know, have I got that down now? Am I perfect? No, but I looked at it and thought, this is a chance that, like, 6 months ago, I didn't think it would ever happen. Yeah. And I still hadn't made my peace with that. So every day that I wake up with Grace and Catherine is, you know, and I'd probably need to be better at that at times because other stuff, you know, present being and mm-hmm. whatever, and, you know, but that Grace is the thing where I look at and I think, no, that gave me something. Like if I'm doing a gig or if I'm doing anything I do, where before it used to be like that thing of getting in my head and as a stand up and that thing of being, you know, the perfect gig or this or that, or really overly analysing myself as a human being or going onto set and thinking that, you know, that kind of pressure goes. Because I think, you know what, like, I'm number one, I want to do something that makes her proud, myself proud. I want to be the best version I can of myself. But actually, there was a time, and it wasn't really that long ago, that I didn't think I'd have any of the stuff sitting in front of me and any of that, you know, to be around. And that would have been, I don't think I'd have come out of that. I don't think I'd be here.
No, it's really beautifully put. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, my friend.
Really appreciate it, brother. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Man Made. You can actually catch Tom's new stand-up tour, Spud Gun. It dates up until the end of the year. The tickets are on sale now. It is brilliant. He is hilarious. Currently in 1,000 Blows, and he's going to be in the upcoming series Reluctant Vampire on the BBC, so make sure you check that out as well. Make sure you rate, review, do all of that stuff on the episode. You know the score by now, and make sure you come back next week for another special guest.